Good day, and welcome to the Half in 10 Center for American Progress and Action conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Madeline Meth. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Madeline Meth, the media coordinator for Half in 10 and the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thank you so much for joining today's call on the legacy of the war on poverty. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded, and by being on the call, you consent to being recorded. We'll be sending around audio from the call as well as the two reports that we'll be discussing today after the call. But if you do have any additional questions, feel free to reach out to me at mmeth@americanprogressaction.org or at 202-741-6277. And now I'll hand the call over to Melissa Boteach, the director of Half in 10 and CAP Action's Poverty to Prosperity program.
Thanks so much, Maddie. And thanks to all of you for joining us for this press call hosted by Half in 10, which is a partnership of CAP Action, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and the Coalition on Human Needs. Today, we're releasing two products to mark the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, including a brand new poll outlining American attitudes on work, economic opportunity, and the safety net, and a report on applying the lessons learned from the War on Poverty to the challenges and opportunities facing a 21st century America. We have several experts here to discuss the findings of these two reports, and they include John Halpin, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a lead author on the polling report, Wade Henderson, the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a partner organization in the Half in 10 campaign, and Peter Edelman, professor of law and faculty director at the Center on Poverty, Inequality, and Public Policy at Georgetown Law Center. He recently published a book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. John, please take it away.
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks to everyone for joining. I'm going to briefly go over some of the top-line findings of our study, and this was a big study of more than 2,000 Americans, including significant oversamples of African Americans, Latinos, and millennials, to assess retrospective opinions about the war on poverty itself and to measure support or opposition to new proposals for fighting poverty in the future. One of the most important things to learn from the research is that the breakdown of the U.S. economy is continuing to be felt by many Americans. Anywhere from one quarter to one third of Americans and even higher percentages of millennials and people of color continue to experience direct economic hardship. 61% of Americans say their family's income is falling behind the cost of living compared to just 8% who feel they are getting ahead and 29% who feel they are staying even. We tested some time series questions that were first developed by NPR, Kaiser, and the Kennedy School back in 2001, directly measuring economic hardship. And anywhere from 25 to 34% of Americans overall and closer to 40% among millennials, African Americans, and Latinos report serious problems falling behind in rent, mortgage, or utility payments, being unable to buy enough food, afford necessary medical care, or keep up with minimum credit card payments. These numbers have somewhat retreated since the immediate post-financial crisis testing we did in 2008, but they are still quite high and show a range of disparities across demographic groups in terms of the uneven nature of the recovery since the Great Recession. Not surprisingly, then, we see a large percentage of Americans who say they have a direct personal connection to poverty. 54% of Americans overall say that someone in their immediate or extended families is poor. This is a figure that has actually increased 2 percentage points since 2008, and nearly 2 in 3 African Americans and 59% of Hispanics report that someone in their immediate or extended families is poor. Given these findings about the difficulties of the overall economy, it's not surprising that when we ask people to estimate the official poverty line, Americans on average estimate that it takes just more than $30,000 in annual income for a family of four to be considered officially in poverty. Now, this is about $7,000 more than the official government line of $23,550 for a household of four. When we tested this idea in focus groups, people were shocked to learn to hear that the official poverty line was so low and wondered how people could get by in a family of four with that little income. We had a follow-up question that asked people to assess what would be the necessary household income for a family to be considered safely out of poverty and into the middle class, and the average response there is $55,000 a year, roughly, which is just above the actual median income in the United States. When we ask people to assess how many people are actually living in poverty, again, the perception of poverty is much greater than the official measures. The public today believes that 39% of their fellow Americans are living in poverty. Now, this is more than twice as high as the official measure of about 15%, and again, reflecting the hardship that many people are feeling, or they feel that other people are feeling, and it sort of flies in the face of other economic indicators that show recovery in terms of employment, consumer confidence, financial markets, and GDP. We tested a variety of attitudinal ideas about why people are in poverty and why, and attitudes about the poor. And what's striking in this survey is how strongly people gravitate towards structural economic causes for poverty above personal ones. One of the things we've seen since the 80s and 90s is a diminishment in sort of harsh negative attitudes about irresponsible behavior of the poor. We had a forced choice question that asked people to choose between two different explanations for why people are in poverty, and 64% of Americans overall believe that most people who live in poverty are poor because their jobs don't pay enough, they lack good health care and education, and things cost too much for them to save ahead. In contrast, only 25% of Americans agree with a more personal cause that most people who live in poverty are poor because they make bad decisions or act irresponsibly in their own lives. Notably, even white conservatives and libertarians, the most conservative on this measure, prefer the structural economic argument over a personal one by a wide margin of 63% to 29%. Along with this finding about the structural economic causes, we find that 79% of Americans agree with the statement that most people living in poverty are decent people who are working hard to make ends meet, again, reflecting this notion that the overall condition of the economy is really driving much of the current poverty rates and the threats that people face. Similarly, 67% of Americans agree that with the statement that many people living in poverty are unfairly criticized by others as lazy or undeserving. Again, reflecting this notion that I mentioned, that harsh negative attitudes towards the poor are receding given the overall challenges that people are facing. They haven't been eliminated. There's still a core of people who believe some of these harsher attitudes. But in general, most Americans understand that those in poverty today are facing real challenges in terms of low wages and high costs. When we tested retrospective evaluations of the war on poverty itself, the responses are mixed. In focus groups, we had very few respondents who could actually talk about the war on poverty. They had very little understanding of what it was or where it came from. Not surprisingly, the term itself is not entirely well understood or doesn't receive entirely favorable ratings. But when we actually explain what President Johnson tried to do with the war on poverty, and ask a series of follow-up questions, we find that the public overwhelmingly agrees that the government has a responsibility to use its resources to fight poverty. 86% of Americans agree with this. Moreover, a majority, 61%, feels that the war on poverty has made a difference, albeit not a major difference in achieving its goals. 41% say the war on poverty has made a minor difference. 20% say it has made a major difference. These retrospective evaluations of the war on poverty are heavily divided by ideology and partisanship. In a follow-up test where we ask presented competing statements about whether the war on poverty worked or did not work, nearly 7 in 10 white liberals and progressives believe the war on poverty has worked, and more than 6 in 10, 64% white conservatives and libertarians believe the opposite. So looking back on the war on poverty itself, there's a strong ideological lens that shapes opinions of that. So despite these mixed feelings about the original war on poverty, what we find is very strong support for a more realistic goal of reducing poverty by half over the next 10 years. Asked whether they would support or oppose the president and Congress setting a national goal to cut poverty in half within 10 years, 7 in 10 Americans say they would support such a goal. 40% of the public would strongly support the goal, and only 22% would oppose it. This figure is quite similar to the test we had in 2008. And support for a national goal of cutting poverty in half is very high among African Americans, 87% support, and reaches roughly 80% among both millennials and Latinos. 65% of whites support this goal, as do a majority of Democrats, 89%, independents, 66%, and Republicans, 54%. In terms of the priorities for fighting poverty today, the public the public's desire is clear. They want to focus on jobs, wages, and education. Asked which two areas they believe are the most important for new investments, 40% of Americans choose creating jobs and increasing wages, 30% choose job training and workplace preparation, 25% choose elementary and secondary education, 23% choose college access. Not surprisingly, then, when we assess 11 different concrete policy prescriptions to fight poverty, all of them receive majority support and quite high and very strong support. And the list, the primary, let me give just a breakdown of the list. The highest supported items are helping low-wage workers afford quality child care, 86% support. Expand nutrition assistance to provide families with healthy food enough to eat, 85% support. Make universal pre-kindergarten available for all children, 84% support. Expand publicly funded scholarships to help more families afford college, 84% support. Increasing the minimum wage and making sure it rises with inflation, 80% support. You have more than 70% support for a range of things to expand the EITC and child tax credit. And we even had nearly three-quarters of Americans supporting subsidized jobs for low-income and long-term unemployed workers. And 68% of Americans in our poll agree with extending the time limit for unemployment insurance during economic downturns, including 81% of Democrats, 63% of Independents, and 55% of Republicans. So what this tells us overall is that the American public will support efforts to expand economic opportunity, increase access to good jobs and wages, and maintain a robust social safety net. I think the harsh negative attitudes about the poor that define political discussions in the 80s and 90s have given way to a public recognition that many Americans, poor and middle class alike, are facing pressures trying to stay afloat and get ahead in a difficult economy. At the same time, supporters of anti-poverty efforts should not be complacent and should recognize that although Americans back government action to reduce poverty, questions remain about the structure and scope of these efforts and how effective they have been over time and how they might be improved. We have the full report that will be sent around. You can see all of these results plus numerous charts and graphs in the entire data set. And with that, I'll turn it over to Wade Henderson at the Leadership Conference.
Thanks, John. Good morning, everyone. As John said, I'm Wade Henderson, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition with more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. Anniversaries such as this provide us with an important opportunity to reflect and to measure our progress as a society. And as this poll shows, President Johnson's call to, quote, replace the despair of the poor with opportunity is just as resonant today as it was 50 years ago. There is no question that the war on poverty has worked, and worked very well, for millions of Americans. And as the results demonstrate, the American consensus is that we need to stick with what's worked while adopting new solutions for today's problems. Today, as when the war on poverty began, African Americans, Latinos, women, and people with disabilities lag behind in almost every indicator of economic well-being, including in poverty rates, employment, education, and health. As John said, the poll we're discussing today oversampled African Americans and Latinos to see if the reality of who is falling behind in today's economy shapes attitudes and opinions on how to solve this national problem. The answer to that question is yes. These communities are much more likely to support national solutions to cut poverty in half, with 87% of African Americans and 79% of Latinos being in favor of solutions to reducing poverty. In many areas, times have never been harder for low-income people and people of color. The cost of living has gone up while wages have stagnated. Education is now the defining factor for economic mobility, yet stubborn disparities put quality education out of reach for millions. And as the economy has squeezed Americans, an ever-shrinking safety net threatens to leave the most impoverished to struggle with no support. Great society programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, Pell Grants, expansions to Social Security, and the SNAP program, the so-called food stamp program, have created opportunity for millions of families to break this cycle and are needed now more than ever. But saving these programs is not enough, and Americans know that. Americans agree that we need to keep the programs we have, but that we must also build an economy that works for everyone by investing in job creation, education, infrastructure, and policies that provide greater opportunity and a hand up to struggling families. The most encouraging news from this poll is that Americans are united in the desire for these solutions. In the short term, this means acting immediately to restore emergency unemployment insurance benefits and preventing any further cuts to nutrition assistance in the Farm Bill. It is now up to Congress to follow popular opinion and get to work. Now, thank you so much for having me on today's call. I'm now pleased to turn the call over to my good friend, Peter Edelman. Peter?
Thank you, Wade. I'm just so pleased to participate in this release of this very important poll. As the discussion of what's happened over the last 50 years about poverty unfolds, and we will hear from many people with differing views about this, we need to understand clearly that we made great progress in the 1960s. Poverty went down from 22% when we started counting in 1959 to 11%, cut in half by 1973. African-American poverty down from 55% to 31% over that period of time. Great progress. Medicaid was clearly a factor in the great reductions in infant mortality that we've had. Food stamps ended the near starvation conditions that Robert Kennedy found, for whom I worked, found in Mississippi in 1967, and I was present with him on that trip. We would not, without the programs that we have, including Social Security, food stamps, earned income tax credit, child tax credit, housing vouchers, and others, poverty would be nearly double now what it is. Our problems would be far worse if we had not taken the steps we have taken. We have effective policies, and they've made a tremendous difference. So why 46 million people in poverty now with all that we have done, all that has worked? Primarily because we've become a low-wage nation. There are certainly other factors, but the failure of our labor market is really at the heart of it. Half the jobs in this country pay less than about $35,000. A quarter of the jobs pay less than the poverty line for a family of four, less than $23,500. The median wage has been stuck in the same place for 40 years. There's been 7% real growth in the median wage over that period of time, a fifth of 1% annually. The economy grew, but literally almost all of it has stuck at the top. So inequality has exploded over the same 40 years. For example, corporate CEOs' pay has gone from 25 times that of the average worker to 288 times that average. We need to be clear that when we talk about inequality, we have to talk about both the top and the bottom, about the 1% and the 99% all the way to the bottom. Thanks for the chance to add these words, and I will turn it over to back to Melissa Botea.
Thank you. I want to conclude by making three key points to sum up and providing a little bit of information on the millennial oversample that points us towards a way forward. The three key points are as follows. As many have emphasized, while many of the programs that emerged from the war on poverty are now taken for granted, the nation would be unrecognizable to most Americans if they'd never been enacted. We detail in the report how initiatives enacted as part of the war on poverty have kept millions of families out of poverty, ended extreme malnutrition, decreased the infant immortality rate, and improved health and educational outcomes. As Peter noted, from 1959 to 1973, we did cut poverty in half, and as our poll indicates, there is broad support for setting a goal to do it again. The second point is that the war on poverty hasn't failed. Our economy has failed. Our society has undergone transformative changes since the 1960s that have both contributed to and alleviated poverty, but too many of our policies and institutions have not kept pace with these realities. Peter detailed the rising income inequality, eroding minimum wage, and how our work and income support system has had to work overtime to compensate for these changes. Other changes in the past 50 years in which we haven't really kept pace with include the fact that in the 1960s, about one quarter of families relied on the mothers as breadwinners or co-breadwinners. Today, that number is two-thirds of families relying on mothers' income, and yet we have not put in place a policy framework to enable families to balance work and caregiving responsibilities. The United States stands alone among nations, developed nations with no paid family leave and no paid sick days, and unfortunately, our child care system remains underfunded and patchwork. Another important demographic shift in the past 50 years is the importance of communities of color. Communities of color constituted 15% of our population in the 1960s. Today, they represent more than 36% and are expected to be the majority of the U.S. population sometime in the early 2040s. While we've made enormous gains in the civil rights movement, communities of color, as Wade noted, are still disproportionately impacted by rates of poverty, unemployment, and poor health and educational outcomes. If we want to have a competitive economy moving forward, we must address these racial and ethnic disparities today. Finally, education. In the 1960s, virtually all men, regardless of educational attainment, were able to participate in the workforce. A high school education was basically a prerequisite for entering the middle class. Today, college is the ticket to the middle class, but college costs have ballooned and too many people are unable to access it. These are all ways in which our country has changed in the past 50 years, and we need to make sure our policies catch up to those realities. To that end, Half in 10 is calling for an investment agenda for the next 50 years. We have our full suite of policy recommendations detailed in our annual report, but these include timely things such as, first and foremost, as Wade said, continuing unemployment insurance and protecting SNAP. First and foremost, we cannot go backwards, and as our poll has demonstrated, there is broad public support for expanding nutrition assistance and continuing unemployment insurance, not cutting these critical work and income supports. There's also broad public support for raising the minimum wage, enacting the president's pre-K and child care initiative, investing in job creation measures, among other recommendations. Finally, turning to the millennial sample, many would ask about how to accomplish this agenda with gridlock in Congress. But according to our poll, there is not only widespread public support for this kind of agenda, but there is even stronger support among the next generation, which gives me hope that moving forward for the next 10 years and the next 50 years, we can make progress. Millennials, a majority of whom have spent most or all of their adult lives in the post-recession economy, are more likely than older voters to be directly affected and are more likely to hold progressive views on poverty and the poor than older Americans. 69% of millennials said they believe the war on poverty has made a difference, despite the fact that they're the generation furthest removed time-wise from the war on poverty. And they are among the most enthusiastic about setting a national goal to cut poverty in half. 79% support such a goal, and even when you qualify by asking if it would require businesses to pay their workers more and provide better benefits, as well as more government spending and taxes, 6 in 10 millennials still express strong support for this goal. Moving forward, we need to put in place the policies to cut the U.S. poverty rate in half. Thank you for your time.
Operator, can we open the call for questions now, please?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And we'll take our first question from Alex Leary with the Tampa Times.
This question for Peter. Peter, can you respond? There's some GOP figures, notably Paul Ryan and more recently Senator Rubio, who have started to discuss poverty and provide at least an outline of what they think should be done. Not a ton of specifics, but I want to get your thoughts on what they've said so far and if you think that's a positive direction.
Well, I see some very few indications that begin to talk sense. In an article in the Washington Post this morning, Senator Mike Lee of Utah is quoted as saying that he would support increases in the child tax credit. The overall theme that I hear from Paul Ryan and others, the Heritage Foundation and others, is essentially that all these things that we've discussed this morning have not worked. And that's just not true, as we've said this morning. And the solution seems to be a combination of people taking more responsibility for themselves, which certainly is part of the answer, and that in terms of help that people would get, that it would be basically volunteerism and emanating from churches and synagogues and mosques, faith-based institutions. So I don't hear much that I think is very constructive about moving us ahead. There's a complete burial of the heads in the ground when we have 1,300,000 people losing their unemployment insurance, and that's just the beginning of a long list. The idea that food stamps that we hear over and over again are people who don't want to go to work, are people who are just kind of sitting at home and having a good time. You know, the food stamps pay if that's all you have, and we have 6 million people in this country who have only food stamps for their income. That's a third of the poverty line. That's $6,000 for a family of three. So I'm not hearing much yet.
And we'll take our next question from Maria Pena with LA Opinion.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I had several, but I'm going to boil it down to just one, and it's follow-up on what Senator Rubio, he's going to be making a speech tomorrow saying that the war on poverty has been an utter failure, and so he's supposedly going to present different proposals for job creation. And I'm just wondering, it would seem to me, what would be your assessment of where we are today in terms of the war on poverty and how minorities are faring today? Are they better or are they worse off? Whether or not President Obama's proposals are just lip service or if they'll actually make a dent on this issue. Thank you.
Maria, this is Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference. Let me offer a brief response and then invite my colleagues to join in. First, I think it would be unfair to criticize Senator Rubio's speech because I haven't heard it. The early reports, however, suggest that at the heart, his proposal to eliminate or repeal Obamacare it's really a veiled effort, as I see it, to repeal Obamacare. And I think it's a misplaced effort in understanding the real workings of our structural system and structural inequality. I am particularly disturbed that some governors have chosen to play politics with Medicaid expansion rather than buying into the importance of a broader Medicaid safety net for those most in need. I also think this poll is really important, obviously, and underscores the degree to which poverty persists. But I think we do ourselves a disservice if we don't recognize that over the last 50 years, many things have changed for the better in this country, and we should acknowledge that. To ask a question of whether people of color are better off today than they were 50 years ago misses a point that, at least to some of us, the obvious, which is today we function in a system without overt racial segregation that was guaranteed both by law and custom. That change alone makes it a better world for many, and one that it would be important to underscore. But I also think we do ourselves a disservice if we don't recognize that structural inequality, that is the inability to provide quality public education, job opportunities for those most in need, do our society a disservice since so many of these individuals in the communities of color will be the workers that our businesses and in personal service we rely upon in the next 20 to 30 years. And the last point I would make was really drawn from a column that Dan Balls of the Washington Post published on Sunday, which linked this issue of income inequality and our ability to address that problem long term to the question of who votes. Our position is very clear. If you don't vote, you don't count. And people of poor people in particular, color people with disabilities, don't turn out at the poll consistent with the political power they have. Our job as advocates going forward is not to lament what the War on Poverty and Great Society programs haven't done. It is to get busy in organizing voters to make a difference at the polls. So when Congress votes today on unemployment insurance and that extension, those who vote against that effort need to be remembered come November when the elections are there to make a difference in who serves us in Congress. And so I've ended at that point. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And at this time, it appears there are no more questions. Thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's call.